All right. Good morning, everybody. It is Tuesday morning, February 23rd, 9 a.m. We're doing Chem 12BL, and we're going to pick up with the multi-step synthesis today and do the last reaction, talk about the last reaction. So I'm still in the process of putting together those videos, and I've been at Cabrillo over the weekend. I think I've got everything I need for the first synthesis in order to get the last of those videos up. So I've got two videos that are sort of in construction, and I've already started the second synthesis. I'm about to start the third synthesis at Cabrillo and filming that part. So those should be coming pretty soon. So let's just review kind of where we left off here. And I've got the screen share up, so everybody can see the screen share. I'm going to put the chat up so I can see that too. And so this is just a quick review of the last notes that we did so that we know where we're at. The first synthesis was going to benzoin. The second synthesis was going from benzoin to benzyl, and that was the oxidation, and that's what we covered. And so we covered that reaction mechanism. We covered sort of reaction oxidations in general. We looked at the procedure and how that reaction runs and how it produces NOx gases. We talked about the workup and the isolation, and we even talked about the separation scheme and what we would look for in terms of products. And this was the benzoin one. I think we did that for benzyl is too. Yes, we did. So here was our benzoin to benzyl. So those are all in the notes from, let's see when this is dated. That's dated 2/16. So that would have been Tuesday of last week. So let's pick it up now. New note. New reaction. And so this is multi-step. This is the third reaction. And I'll draw just a quick description of the entire process. So we went from benzaldehyde to benzoin. We went from benzoin to benzyl, and with three reactions, I got to tighten it up a bit. We oxidized this using nitric acid, and we went to benzyl. And this was the thiamine catalyst in the first step, nitric acid in the second step.
Oh, thank you. Perfect.
Come on. He may not go out. He may stay.
Can he stay?
Yeah, he can stay. Okay. Come on, buddy. All right, Finn is in the house. He's going to hang out with me. And then the last step is a base catalyzed. So we do one potassium hydroxide and two, we do acid. And in this step, it goes through an isomerization. And I'm getting too tight in there, so I'm going to spread this out a little bit. I don't need to be quite that stingy with space. And that's our isomerization product. So the step that we're going to do now is this third reaction. the benzyl to benzylic acid. All right, so in this step, this base catalyzed reaction, we do it on a much smaller scale. If you remember sort of scale-wise, when we started, we starting masses, we started with approximately a gram of the benzaldehyde. And then when we did the benzoin synthesis, we started with 0.3 grams. When we start the benzyl synthesis, we start with approximately 0.1 grams. And so each step of the way, we're losing material in these synthesis. And so we don't have all that much to move forward with as we move on from step one to step two to step three. So we start with a much smaller reaction to begin with, 0.1 grams of this material. And I haven't calculated how many millimoles that is. We can look at it. But this reaction is similarly going to be done in a small conical vial, a 3 mil conical vial this time. So our first reaction, we did this in a 25 mil round bottom flask. The second one we did in a 5 mil conical vial. And now we're going to move into a 3 mil conical vial. Each time we're sizing the glassware appropriately for the size of the reaction that we're doing and the amount of material that we're using in that reaction so that we're generally not filling that vial any more than halfway filled when we consider all of the materials that are going to go into it. Okay, so procedure-wise, well, let's talk mechanism-wise first. Let's look at how this mechanism works. And then we'll go through the procedure. This is a base catalyzed reaction. And we use, I don't know if it's got the concentration of the potassium hydroxide. It does not tell me, so we'll have to go back and calculate what it is, but I think it is like a 6 molar potassium hydroxide solution. And we heat this to near refluxing conditions. And so what happens is that hydroxide, I'll do it from here, is a nucleophile. And based on the partial positives and partial minuses in the molecule on the benzyl, we've got a partial positive at the carbonyl base, partial minus, so you've got that dipole on the carbonyl. This guy attacks that, breaks the bond, and shifts the electrons up onto the oxygen. We go to what's called a tetrahedral intermediate, and we're going to see something that is very common for carbonyl type chemistry. And that is that oftentimes when a carbonyl opens up, it finds a way to regenerate by kicking out a leaving group. And in this case, it's not clear what the leaving group can be in terms of this molecule and this guy closing back up. It doesn't look like it has any place to go. However, what happens, interestingly, this is the critical step, is the electrons push back in and this group, this bond breaks and acts as a leaving group. But what it does is it migrates, making a new carbon-carbon bond. This bond breaks and the electrons shift up onto the oxygen. So that regenerates my carbonyl. That shifts over the aromatic ring system. I get the O minus. And that's sort of what's left. My aromatic ring wasn't looking as pretty as I want. Okay. The potassium is the counter ion. And that potassium is still hanging out here as the counter ion. But this isn't the final product. What winds up happening here is while I've had the migration, I have two functional groups here, which are very different in their acidities. I have an alkoxide and I have a carboxylic acid. And in terms of competing bases, when I look at alkoxides and carboxylates, the alkoxide is far more basic than the carboxylic acid. And so this proton actually shifts, and most people will draw this just with an arrow taking the proton, but I think it's a far better thing to do this as a solvent-assisted process, that if we consider this alkoxide to be a really strong base, then the best thing to do is to take and to shuttle this proton using a base-assisted or using a solvent-assisted method rather than just doing it internally within the molecule. Most of these things are all solvent-assisted when you're looking at protonations and deprotonations. And then that base that you generated takes the proton away. And I like to do the protonation first and then the deprotonation so that I go through a neutral molecule as opposed to a molecule that has two negative charges in it. So I try to avoid the two negative charges. And then this is the potassium benzylate. And this is an intermediate that we actually isolate. And then from there, we take and we protonate this with dilute acid in the workup. And I think that we use either a 1 molar or a 3 molar, 1 molar hydrochloric acid. And then that makes the benzylic acid. And that's our final product. So the rearrangement that we're looking at is oftentimes referred to as a pentacol-pentacolone type rearrangement. And it's pentacol-pentacolone is a famous rearrangement that that works in this way, where you have a base attacking a carbonyl, the carbonyl opens up and you have a migration of a group. And so that's what we're seeing here. And under these strongly basic conditions with refluxing temperatures, sometimes you can see molecules getting chewed up in rearrangements, and this is just going to a more stable configuration. That's what the benzoic acid represents, is a thermodynamically more stable configuration of our starting benzyl molecule that is conducted through base catalysis. Okay, so that's the overall reaction. Let's go through how we actually put it together, and then we'll look at a separation scheme. Unless there's any questions, just checking to see how you guys are doing. Nothing in the chat. Everybody seems to be okay.
I had a question.
Keegan, go for it.
So at the end where we had the deprotonation and then protonation of the same location, is that just because you had leftover base that you can't really stop from doing that?
You can't. I mean, this is a good thing to talk about too, that if we look at the functional groups and we look at ROH, the pKa on an alcohol proton like this is in the 15.7, 16 range. Usually we equate it to water and we say 15.7. When we look at a carboxylic acid, the pH or the pKa on a proton on a carboxylic acid is 4.5. So if we take those two and we consider putting them into a table, let's say that the most acidic is the carboxylic acid and then its conjugate, the carboxylate, and the alcohol and its conjugate, the alkoxide. We have most acidic and then, as conjugates go, the most basic. And so this guy is the strong acid and the weak base. This is the weak acid and the strong base. And what we said is that in these equilibriums, if we were to think about these as competing equilibriums, and we had the carboxylic acid reacting with the alkoxide and an equilibrium to the carboxylate and the alcohol, and we ask which side of this equation gets favored, this is the strong acid, strong base. This is the weak base and the weak acid. And we said that these reactions always favor the weak side. So in terms of equilibrium, when we look at the equilibrium of this, with these, we always favor the weak side. Because those strong acids and strong bases react together to produce the weak base and the weak acid. And so the question is, you know, is it the extra potassium hydroxide and the basic conditions that are in the solution that are promoting this and causing this to happen? And the answer is no. The answer is that it is actually the functional groups themselves that would cause this to happen in the absence of that strongly basic conditions. It would still happen because these two functional groups are incompatible and they will fall to their weak side and they will auto-catalyze themselves. So when we think about the acid that I'm throwing in here and the base that I'm throwing in here, B minus is this alkoxide and BH is this carboxylic acid. And it just auto-catalyzes. It's just, I don't like to just draw an arrow from within one molecule and do it because I don't feel that that does these mechanisms justice, because I think that these things are oftentimes solvent assisted. And while that proton can configure, if we think about one, two, three, four, five, that this can form a five-membered ring system, and so it can react internally and transfer that proton pretty easily. But it's probably a combination of both intermolecular and intramolecular reactions in the transfer of that proton. Does that help, Keegan?
Yeah, that helps. But if that's the case, then how do we ever get it to be stable in the final form that has
the two protons?
Yeah.
Well, that's what happens is we take it and then we acidify it. And once we acidify it, we take this reaction and we add one molar HCl, and you're adding sufficient acid to it to be able to protonate all functional groups and to isolate it in its molecular form. And so then after protonation, we can isolate both in the molecular form, because it's really the part that we were competing with was the alkoxide base versus carboxylate base. But if we just protonate everything by adding HCl, then we come to a neutral molecule. And while I've been drawing these with different R groups, we can consider these R groups to be a ring system or a chain that links these two functional groups within the same molecule. Okay. Anything come up for anybody else? Okay, let's take a look at how we set this up. We're going to be heating this reaction. And so essentially our reaction setup is going to look like a 5-mol conical vial or 3-mol conical vial. We'll have a spin vein in there. We're going to set this up using a sand bath as a heating apparatus. That's going to go on top of a hot plate. The hot plate will go up on a jack stand. Some drawing kind of got away from me. All of a sudden, I can't draw this morning. That's better. And so we'll put this whole thing on a jack stand. It's also harder drawing with a dog in your lap. And then we put the air condenser onto this guy. We put a thermometer down inside the sand bath. To be able to track our temperature. We put a ring stand back behind this guy and we clamp it on the thermometer and we clamp it on there. And then the sand, what we do is we kind of pile the sand up about the height of the solution that is going to go inside this. And of course, this gets that cap that goes on it too, that locks the system together. And so that's what our entire reaction looks like. And we're going to heat this to approximately 100 degrees Celsius. So that's our setup. Procedure wise, we're going to place approximately 0.10 grams of the benzyl into 0.3 milliliters of 95% ethanol. Let's see. Into a conical vial. With spin vane and air condenser. You're going to add 0.30 milliliters of 95% ethanol. And then you're going to heat approximately 100 degrees C until the material all dissolves. Then you're going to add 0.25 milliliters of potassium KOH aqueous solution. And the KOH is, I'm trying to remember if it's 6 molar or 8 molar. Let me find my calculator. Calculate real quick for us. So it was 2.75 grams divided by 56.1056 gives me 0.05 moles divided by 0.006 liters. It's 8 molar. And you add that dropwise through the condenser. Just using a pipette. And then you boil this for 15 minutes. The solution is going to turn a blue-black color. Some people's will look more black, some people's will look more blue as the reaction proceeds. And after the end of the reaction, we drop the heat and we cool to room temperature. At this point, you're going to then start, this isn't really the workup phase, just, I guess it is kind of the workup phase. That's the end of the reaction. Let's call this the workup phase. You transfer the contents to a 10 milliliter beaker. This is a little baby beaker, and everybody like freaks out at how small this little beaker is and how cute this little thing is. It's just a 10 milliliter beaker. And you ice bath this for about 15 minutes. You may need to scratch scratching rod to induce crystallization. it doesn't go on its own. Usually it goes on its own. Once it crystallizes, then we are going to Hirsch it. So we Hirsch funnel and rinse with 3 mils of ice cold 95% ethanol. Okay, once we get that, that is the potassium benzylate. So the material that we're isolating there is the potassium salt. So what we don't want to do, nope, that's not the OH. What we don't want to do is we don't want to rinse this with water. Once in a while, when people filter this, they think, oh, I'm going to rinse this with water. And I've seen this mistake happen numerous times. This is highly water soluble. You're rinsing with 95% ethanol. What we don't want to do is we do not want to rinse with water. If you rinse it with water, you just dissolve it and all of your solid goes through the funnel and it all recombines with the ethanol solution that was in the Hirsch funnel and you lose it and it's almost impossible to recover. So you definitely do not want to rinse this with water. From here, what we're going to do is we're going to actually start to set up to form the benzoic acid. So now what we're going to do is we're going to take this solid and transfer the solid to another 10 mil Erlenmeyer flask containing 3 mils of hot water. This is a 10 milliliter Erlenmeyer. And if you thought the beakers were cute, a 10 milliliter Erlenmeyer flask is crazy small. And we do that with 3 mils of hot water. You stir until it dissolves. And then we look to see if there's any remaining solid. So this is a check and an optional procedure that may need to be done. The material should all dissolve. The potassium benzylate or the solid should all dissolve because it should be highly soluble in water. Anything that doesn't dissolve is not your product. And so if you have any remaining solid, then we need to filter it out. Would humidity also affect this lab? The answer is no, not so much with this, because we're working with 95% ethanol, which has a certain amount of water in it already, a small amount of water, and a little bit of water isn't going to hurt anything that we're doing in this reaction. When you're working with acids and bases, water generally isn't a problem. It's when you're trying to work in the absence of acids and bases, when you're trying to work in purely organic solvents, that sometimes water can be a problem, like in the Grignard reaction. So yeah, the humidity doesn't really hurt this. Okay, so if there are solids, then we filter the solution. On what's called C-Lite. And in order to do that, what we do is we take and we use a Hirsch funnel. The Hirsch funnel has that filter plate inside it. And normally what we do is we take and we put a little piece of paper inside of this to do the filter on. And this whole thing then gets set up inside the sidearm flask that we pull vacuum on. However, that paper isn't sufficient to be able to filter out these fine solids. And so what we do is we take and we make a solution of C-Lite, a suspension of C-Lite really, in a beaker. So this is water and I think it's like 0.5 grams of C-Lite. C-Lite is extremely fine diatomaceous earth. It is a non-reactive substrate that is just super, super like talc. It is super fine. And what we do is we take that solution and we pour it over this. And what it does is it makes a filter cake and we get this buildup that happens right in here. That is the C-Lite filter cake. And then we take and we pass our material over the top of that. And so what comes through here is this then is the H2O and potassium benzylate. This is your product. Usually when we filter something and we pass something through a filter like this, what we want is the material on the funnel. Normally what we're trying to do is we're trying to isolate the solid and capture the solid and take that and that's our product. In this case, it's the exact reverse. What we're doing is we have a material that is now in another little beaker. And this is our aqueous potassium benzylate. And there's little material in here that we want to get rid of that are impurities. And in fact, maybe what we should do is just make them red. And so those impurities are going to wind up on the filter plate. And the thing that we want is going to wind up in the solution. And that's what we're going to move forward with. Is this making sense? Okay. So after we do that, then what we're going to do is now we're going to start the acidification process. So we're going to add with stirring half a milliliter of 1 molar hydrochloric acid. They want you to take the pH down to about a pH of 2. And the reason that you're doing that is because if you look at a carboxylic acid, the pKa on a carboxylic acid, as we said, was 4.5. You want to get approximately 2 pKa units down below the pKa to make sure that all of the material is fully protonated so that it all becomes molecular. And because you're in water, the neutral molecular benzylic acid should precipitate. Then what you're going to do is you're going to cool this down to room temperature and ice it. For 5 to 10 minutes, making sure that we're taking that solubility down so that everything precipitates out. Then you're going to Hirsch funnel filter it again. Let's say filter on Hirsch. And then we'll get a mass, a melting point, and FTIR. And we'll do the characterization part. And that's the whole thing. So a little bit lengthier reaction on this one because of the workup that's involved. So let's take a look at that workup. Let's take a look at that in a separation scheme sense. In a separation scheme, you have your starting material. Which is in the which is the benzyl. You have KOH and water and 95% ethanol. All of that stuff is in there. We have our product that we make. This product is the potassium salt, so we'll list it as the potassium salt. And then it's unclear what other impurities could be formed in this. So we're not going to draw any other impurities or any other reactions. But this, when we add the KOH, this material precipitates out and we get a solid and we get a liquid. The solid should be the potassium benzoate. The liquid should be everything else. Okay, and then there may be some impurities that are in with this potassium benzoate. And so what we do is we take and we add water to this. This could create a little bit of solid and or liquid. The solid, the only thing that's going to be solid are impurities. And that this is where we would filter these out. So this is the filtration step with C-Lite if needed. That's what that step represents. Otherwise, what we get is our water and our potassium benzoate. And then to this, we take and we add HCl. And there we create two phases as well. We create a liquid and a solid. The solid is your benzoic acid. And the liquid is going to be water and potassium chloride from the potassium salts and any remaining HCl that's going to be in there. So that's the overall separation scheme. And just that one step there that represents the optional filtration, that if there happen to be impurities in there, there are solid impurities when we try to dissolve it in the water, then those are the things that need to be filtered out on C-Lite. And this one, we don't do a recrystallization. You have so little material here that there's really not enough to recrystallize. And by way in which you've gone through and isolated it, you have isolated it using the solubility of potassium benzoate, that really there's nothing else that's going to be ionic that's going to be able to travel through this process and make it through this process. And so the benzoic acid comes out essentially as pure as if you were to do a recrystallization. So we really don't need, there's no needed for a recrystallization step in this one. Okay. I'm trying to think, oh, maybe we should do and talk about what to look for spectroscopically. How do we analyze this? What are we looking for? These two materials have very similar masses. They're not identical. But melting point wise, which one of these do you expect to have the higher melting point? Yeah, benzoic acid. So this one was 95 degrees Celsius was the melting point on the benzyl. On benzylic acid, the expected melting point is 150. So a considerably higher melting point. And we expect that from the hydrogen bonding that we only have dipole-dipole. But here we're going to get H bonding. And interestingly, carboxylic acids tend to do what's called dimerization. So that when you look at a carboxylic acid, carboxylic acids in the way that they H bond, dimerize. So if we take two carboxylic acids and we flip one over, they do hydrogen bonding in this way. And they make a dimer. And that substantially increases the melting point of the carboxylic acid in the way that they dimerize. Okay, and spectroscopically, what we're looking at too is that in the benzyl material, when we looked at its FTIR, we were looking at just carbon hydrogen stretches. And then I believe that we had two that were in the 1700 range, even though they are two of the same carbonyls, we get two stretches that look like they could be carbonyl stretches. Verify that, look at, see if I have that spectrum. Yeah, they're pretty close to each other. And this one's around 1700. What we see with the benzylic acid is that we get a sharp peak and that it's right next to a jagged one. And then we get the carbonyl. And then we get the fingerprint region. So there's all this other stuff that goes on. So this is right around 1700. I need to look up the exact number. But what we're looking at is we're looking at the hydroxyl group, which is this functional group, which shows up here. And then the carboxylic acid, which is that guy, which shows up in this part here. And this sharp peak, this is a non-hydrogen bonding hydroxyl. When you have a hydroxyl group that is oftentimes buried in a molecule where there's a lot of steric hindrance, that hydroxyl group can't easily hydrogen bond with other groups. When it can't hydrogen bond, the peak resolves and sharpens, and we get a single peak as opposed to the broad sort of sweep that we would normally expect with a hydroxyl. And so that's what this one demonstrates, is it demonstrates that sharp peak to the left of where the carboxylic acid shows up. And then you get the carbon hydrogen stretches that, come in between. So we get ROH, we get ROH carboxylic acid, and here we get the carbon hydrogen stretch. And then we also have, let's do it this way. That's that piece. And then we have the carbonyl, which is here. And that carbonyl for the carboxylic acid is showing up there. And for the carbonyls over here, these guys are showing up in that one. And so those are the changes that we're looking for, or changes to note as we look at the IR for the benzoic acid. Okay. I think that's pretty much it. When we start to look at how this reaction goes together, let me go back up and grab the reaction up at the top rather than redrawing the whole thing. What we're going to be doing is calculating an overall percent yield. And so while each step has its own percent yield, the synthesis overall has a percent yield. So right now what we're looking at is we're looking at approximately a 50% yield on this first reaction. Let's call this one X percent and this one Y percent, because I don't know what those percentages are going to be yet. So each step has its own yield. The overall yield is going to be reaction one, percent reaction one divided by 100 times percent reaction two divided by 100 times percent reaction three divided by 100, and then all of that times 100 to put it back into percent, and that's the overall isolated yield. And so basically what we would have is this would be your X percent. This would be your Y percent. Oops. Whoa. I don't even know how that just happened. Done. Slipped into a different application overall. This is your 50% from reaction one. This typically falls somewhere in the approximately 5 to 3% range overall. Based on all these steps. So you can imagine trying to do a reaction, something like Taxol, that has some amazing 27, 28 steps, and trying to synthesize something that has that many steps and keep the percents super high is really hard, which is why that they frequently do solid phase synthesis. Ooh, this is just a quick aside. You guys ready for just a quick aside, just to show you something that's really cool? Because where are we losing all this material? We're losing all this material in mechanical manipulations a lot, right? And so, imagine if you could do this. Imagine if you could take a bead, a polymer, and that polymer has functional groups on it. Those functional groups can be many different types of functional groups. And then this is hooked to what you want to call your substrate. And then you take and you do transformations on this. So we do reaction one, and then we do reaction two, and then we do reaction three. And so eventually what happens is your substrate gets converted. It's still attached to the bead. And because it's attached to a physical bead, there's no loss. And your substrate, let's say that your substrate had an alcohol And we took that alcohol and we made some new molecule and we did something to it and added a bunch of things onto it. And then what we do is we cleave it. And we cleave it from the bead so that what we wind up doing is we wind up breaking this bond that is essentially here. And we release this molecule. And now that we've released this molecule, all of these were essentially 100% yields because there was no way to lose the bead. There's no mechanical loss. You're not losing powder along the way. You're not losing anything when you recrystallize. In fact, you don't even need to recrystallize because your material is attached to a bead and can't come off. And so you lose next to nothing as you go through and do this. And you may not be doing three steps. You may be doing 50 steps. And then you cleave at the end of those 50 steps, and then you get your material off. This is how they oftentimes do peptide synthesis, is they take and they use a bead that they attach the peptide to, and then they do one amino acid after another, and it may be 50 steps or 100 steps. And then at the end of it, they cleave it, and they get essentially nearly 100% yield because there was never any loss of the material on the bead, which is really quite cool. Quite astounding. So this is called a solid phase synthesis, where all the synthesis happens while the material is attached to a solid phase. And so all you do is you simply wash your beads. And as long as you don't drop or lose any beads, all of your material stays attached to it. And then at the end, you cleave it from the bead and you release your material and you get your yield that way. So there are other schemes, other ways of doing synthesis that that can do better than these high loss types of reactions. But this is just an aside, just to give you an idea of other ways that we can do these types of things. Okay, any questions on this synthesis? No, it's good. Okay, so I'm gonna keep trying to finish out these videos. Like I said, I've got a new, I don't know if I showed you guys, I sent an email out. I haven't been showing people yet. At chemed.study. Why is it not going? What I put in is a new experiment videos tab right here. And so if you go to that tab, then I've got them broken down by experiment. So we've got the synthesis of triphenyl methanol. I've got the benzoin part one, and I'll put the oxidation and the next reactions in there. I'll finish out that benzoin reaction. I think I'm gonna try and get that finished for Wednesday, or at least I'll get more videos up by Wednesday. I won't get them up today. How do I want the lab notebook set up and all the procedures written together or separate? Treat them as individual experiments in your lab notebook. So each one, each step, step one, two, and three, from from benzaldehyde to benzoin as one step and one complete experiment in the notebook, from benzoin to benzyl, another experiment, and from benzyl to benzylic acid, a third experiment yet. The actual combination of them comes in the write-up, in writing them up as a single experiment. But in your lab notebook, you treat them as separate experiments. Yes, JC, each one. The purpose may be the same in that you're working on a multi-step and that you are trying to do a larger project. What did I write out in mine? I'll give you an idea. What I wrote as the purpose. to demonstrate multi-step synthesis, introduction to larger project-based experiments. So that was my overall purpose over the entire thing. And yes, they each have their own title. So you title each one out in the, here, stop. I don't have a good way to show this to you, but at least I can, you can pin it so you can see on a big screen. And I'll try to show you what I did. All right, so what I have is the first experiment of benzaldehyde going to benzoin. I have my purpose. I have my procedure written out. That procedure continues over, and then I have my data that I'm taking as I'm taking each one of my experiments. And then I move into my next experiment where I have benzoin going to benzyl, and I have a purpose, and then I have my procedure. My procedure continues into my workup, and then I have all my data that I'm taking. And so, yes, I'm treating them as individual experiments as I'm going through and doing them in my laboratory notebook. And then I have some points where I'm going back and taking data, like this goes back to the first experiment, even though this is the last thing that I did. This has some of the benzoin numbers here where I've gone through and taken some of the masses on the dried benzoin that I went back and did. And so remember, we talk about the notebook as being a notebook in as a daily record, as a sequential daily record, not an experiment record, but a daily record of what you actually do in lab. Now yours, because you're watching videos, you're going to watch them all sequentially, even though I'm doing things out of order in my laboratory notebook, or I'm doing things out of order in the lab, your experiment, as you watch the videos, will be sequential. And so you won't have to worry about that. All of your data will be broken up into individual discrete experiments. Let's see. Did I hit all of the questions? I think I did. Anything else come up? All right, that's all I have for you guys for today until we can get some of those videos up and you guys can really get working on them. Yeah, and if things come up, you know, we're going to have more sessions where we can talk about these things and we can sit down and we can talk about the formal report and all the questions and get all your questions answered as well. So there'll be plenty of time for all of that as well. Okay. All right, that's all I've got for you today. If you want to treat the rest of our time a little bit like office hours, if you want to stay on the line, you have questions, or you want to have a little bit of FaceTime with me off recording, I'm happy to do that as well. So I'm going to go ahead and end the recording. And other than that, I'm going to let you guys go. And you're welcome to take off, and I'll see you later at 12:40 for lecture. Okay? All right, sounds good. I'll stop the recording, and I'll hang out here. And if you have questions, stay on the line.